Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Normally when we record these podcasts, Andrew, I speak to you from the comfort of my own flat. But today, I'm not in my flat. I'm in a Ford Fiesta ST edition in the lovely town of Lynmouth.
Where's Lynmouth? Oh, it's down Exmoor, isn't it?
Just off Exmoor, yeah, overlooking the Bristol Channel. It's a beautiful town. I'm sat in a car park overlooking the river that runs through the town. You might be able to hear it in the background. But it's a very pretty little place. I'm just a bit aware that after dark, public car parks can become a bit more sinister. But I think in this part of the world, we're okay.
Yes, yes. Goodness knows what people may be thinking you're getting up to in a public car park after dark in that part of the world. But we will leave that to people's imagination.
Yeah, quite. Okay, so now you know why it might sound a little bit different in here. It might be a bit echoey or a bit less echoey, I don't know. But anyway, we're not talking about where I'm recording this podcast. We're talking about racing. We go racing.
Yes.
It's a good topic, isn't it? There's plenty of stuff to talk about. But before we get stuck in, we should just say, we understand, don't we, that not everyone gets to go racing for free the way that we do, and that motorsport in almost all its forms is enormously expensive.
Yeah. Even the cheapest form of motorsport, and believe me, I've done some in my time, it's not like doing a track day. You can do things like, and we've spoken about them on this podcast, particularly in our sort of track day podcast that we did, I think, back in October. We've spoken about doing sort of auto tests around car parks and the very sort of most affordable ways that you can do something competitive in a car. The moment there's a kind of checkered flag involved and being on track with a few other people and lap times actually being important, It does get expensive. It just does, because cars get crashed, engines blow up, entry fees. I can remember, even when I was racing a Renault Clio, years back, the bills were really, really horrible. And it's why, if I'm honest with you, almost everybody who does what we do for a living cannot afford to race on their own ticket, which is why we tend to leap at any opportunity to race absolutely anything at all, as long as it doesn't involve putting our hands in our pockets, because our pockets are just not deep enough to do it. If they were, I would. And there was a time before inconvenient things like children came along when I did pay for my own racing. One example, okay, I once had, I was very lucky, I had a 993 RS Porsche 911, and I wanted to go racing, so I sold it, and that bought a part share in a Chevy Camaro, which I raced for 2 seasons. I never crashed it, I never blew it up, and at the end of it, I didn't have enough money to go racing, and I didn't have a 911. So in 2 seasons of what I thought was pretty budget historic motorsport in a bomb-proof car, it ate a 993 RS in cash. So that's, so the point of all this is we understand that a lot of people, maybe even most, maybe even the vast majority of people listening to this who might love to race aren't able to race. And we understand how lucky and privileged we are that, you know, sometimes quite a lot, sometimes very occasionally, but, you know, sometimes at least we do get to race. And I don't want anybody thinking that we are, that we have kind of failed to recognize that fact and are in any way other than, you know, ridiculously lucky to get to do what we do.
Yeah, I would feel like a total charlatan if I didn't disclose this now. I've never spent a penny of my own money on racing, because of, as you say, I actually just can't afford to.
Yeah,
I've paid to do a little bit of rallying and some karting and bits and pieces, but never circuit racing. In fact, I've only done 7 or 8 weekends, so I've not done a great deal of racing at all. But it's all been covered by manufacturers or by somebody else. And I'm well aware of how fortunate I am to have done that stuff. But, you know, I see in my future, one way or another, at some point, a racing car that I own and use as often as I can. You know, I'm determined that I will pay my own way in motorsport at some point.
Yeah, so if you'd like to see Dan going road racing of his own ticket, if you'd like to sign up to us and give us some money on Patreon, which would be absolutely lovely, Patreon / Drive Nation, the Dan in particular would be absolutely delighted if you did.
Yes, might be waiting a little while for that.
Indeed.
Okay, all right, well, let's talk about it then. So why do we race then? What do we get out of it, and how does it improve us as drivers?
I can get quite philosophical here.
Well, hang on, this is good, because I really want to get into the philosophy of it, because you, as much as anyone I've ever met, consider it a way of life, really, don't you?
Well, I can't. Well, it's good of you to say that. I can't really, because I can't afford to do it. And, you know, I'm you know, more than anything else, I am always very aware that I do it as somebody else's guest, whether that guest is a car manufacturer or a friend or whatever. And it's one of the reasons that when it goes away, because usually somebody sold the car, I'm racing, I never get down to the chops about it, because I can only think how lucky I've been to race it at all in the first place. But insofar as I suppose the time will come when I stop, because, you know, sooner or later, you know, something will happen, or I will go slow, you know, not be as quick as I used to be, or whatever. For everybody, the time comes when they stop racing, and I hope I'm able to greet that with, you know, equanimity. But yeah, I would find it hard to imagine not racing, only because I've been doing it for such a long time. But the philosophical, I mean, you asked why we did it and why I was going to get just briefly, and I promise you I won't get this profound again. I think it goes back to almost to the cave. I think it goes back to being, you know, it has been in man's instincts to be competitive from the first moment, you know, he emerged from his cave and went off chasing the local wildlife because he needed something for dinner. And I think the need to compete, to frankly, in very real terms, to be faster than the person next to you, has been around with us for as long as we've been around. And I think that is why, you know, it's not just car racing, isn't it? You know, all forms of competition, you know, people running around tracks, or, you know, people racing horses, or swimming in the swim, it doesn't matter. You're trying to prove that you are faster than the person next to you. And I think it ultimately all comes down to that. And I think it does resonate with something pretty primal within us. And I think it is why also, and I put this out as a sizable health warning, if you are lucky enough to do it just once, you're going to really struggle to not do it again, because it bites you. And once you get bitten, you stay bit. It is utterly addictive. And it is why I find the idea of never racing quite difficult to understand. But I mean, as I say, the time will come. But I think it is deep, deep within us. And yeah, because we love cars, that's just the way we choose to manifest it, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. I think there's another element that there's the sort of conquering the danger aspect as well. I'm sure that must be a sort of deep-seated primal thing as well. Because there is an element of danger. Everyone's aware of it when they step into a car. And there is some bizarre, perverse joy to be had in you know, facing up to that danger and overcoming it, and with a great result or quick lap time or something. So it's quite a base instinct, isn't it, that makes us strap ourselves into these cars and drive out onto the circuit?
Do you know, I've spent so long thinking about exactly that, because I would not describe myself as being a thrill seeker. I hate horror films. I hate roller coasters. I hate anything, any of those things that people, for some reason, I've never understood. I've got a daughter who's like this, who choose to go and do these things simply because they are designed to scare them. I don't like being scared. It's not, it's not an emotion that I feel comfortable with. I think you're designed not to feel comfortable with it. So for me, the fear factor is kind of the price that I pay to be able to do what I love. And I don't know whether that speaks to something deep within me or not, but I spent so much time thinking about why I did. I mean, yeah, and usually most of the time I find myself thinking about this is when I'm sitting on the grid, and you will know this as well as me. You're sitting there in the assembly area, or maybe you're about to go off and do your green flag lap, where you'll parade out onto the track and find your space on the grid. And in that moment, right there and then, I don't think I've ever done a race where if somebody said, actually, you can get out of the car now and just go to the pub and have a pint, I don't think I would ever have thought to myself, no, I'm going to stay in the car. I absolutely hate it. The preparation, the contemplation, and when you're sitting there and there's nothing else going wrong and you've got all these idiots around you, and the imagination starts to run away with you of all the things that could go wrong. And there are any number of ways in which they can and do go wrong. And you just think, you sit there thinking, what am I doing here? How have I got myself into this place where I'm strapped into this thing with all these people who I don't know? And for what? I'm going to go round and round in circles for half an hour, however long it is, try not to crash, and then nobody will ever remember it ever again. It seems like the most pointless pursuit. And then suddenly, you know, a flag gets waved or some lights go out, and you become a different person. In that instant, you just become a different person. You wouldn't recognise the person you were 5 seconds earlier. And you're in the race and you're having a whale of a time, and you never, ever, ever want it to end. You know, and I've done plenty of really long races, and I never want them to end. I'm always up for getting back in the car. It is the most peculiar thing. But but the fear for me, and I race, you know, some pretty weird stuff, which I think a lot of people would regard as being phenomenally dangerous. And all I would say is that, you know, if they are dangerous, and they probably are, that is absolutely not why I race them.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. So you're right. There's a competitive instinct, and we just happen to channel it through motorsport. But there's another aspect, isn't there, that if you enjoy driving, there is no other form of it that is so thrilling and so rewarding. That applies to motorsport generally, doesn't it? Once there's a stopwatch involved, there's just something about it. You've got your helmet on, there's a stopwatch involved, and then all of a sudden it's the most thrilling type of driving imaginable. And it knocks track days into a cocked hat, doesn't it? And you know, those corporate experience days, they're like nothing compared to proper motorsport.
Yeah, it's the competitiveness, isn't it? It's the other people around you. What it does, I think, is it makes you find things in yourself.
It does.
That you don't know that. And there's a very real example I can use to help, I hope, illustrate this, in that I'm sure there have been races I've done where I have been quicker in qualifying than I have been in the race. But I just don't remember any of them. The cars I race, you don't have sort of qualifying tyres or anything else. You just go out and you do a time. And I always go quicker in the race. Always. Because, you know, suddenly, you know, being up against the watch and trying to do a lap time is all one thing. But when there's a bloke trying to hunt you down and you don't want him to hunt you down, so you want to get away from the bugger, then, you know, you just find something within you that which is not there in qualifying, and certainly not there on a track day, where, frankly, the only thing that matters is that you get to go home in one piece. And that is a dimension of driving I don't think you can experience unless you've raced. And that is what I find, and that is what is so addictive about it. It is that It is a sort of voyage of discovery. You are finding out things about yourself, and you know, to the extent that, you know, what am I? I'm 55 now, and I still go off and I do races, and I will drive. I'll do a lap at a certain speed, which I wouldn't have thought I was capable of doing before the race, because I would have, you know, I would have gone out in qualifying and I would have driven the car as fast as I know how to drive it, because that's what you do. You don't leave anything on the table. And yet, perhaps even without trying quite so hard in the race, you somehow manage to go faster still. And I'm still trying to figure that one out. But I think being competitive, you know, having the adrenaline pumping the way that it is, you just do things you didn't think you could do. And that's probably what I love most about it.
Yeah. And do you know what's brilliant about it, actually? Just thinking about it now, is that you get that same kick, perhaps just to a marginally lesser degree, in a little shopping hatchback adapted for a racetrack as you do something really, really fast. Because it's not necessarily the speed or the price of the car that gives you that. It is the competition. And as long as there is equal competition around you, you will get that rush.
Oh, you know, I can remember I did a 24-hour race at Silverstone in an MX-5. Which I shared with Jethro Bovingdon, I'm sure you all know, Matt Pryor from Autocar, and Ben Anderson from Autosport. And it was an MX-5, and it was a 24-hour race on the Grand Prix circuit of Silverstone. You might be thinking, that must have just really dragged. And it was just wonderful. It was just fantastic. We Jota were running the car, who are the absolute best in the business. So we knew that we were in a really, really good car. And because the car was so beautifully set up, it was so well balanced, because I was doing it with my mates, and it just kind of all came together. And, you know, that is one of my most fond racing memories, even though I've been blessed to race some stupidly expensive stuff and some really quite fast stuff. You're absolutely right. You can have as much fun skidding about in an MX-5. If the car is, you know, if the car's a bit of a is a bit of a nail, and it's, you know, and it's frightening you because it's not set up properly, or it's so much slower than anything else out there, you're not actually racing. That is something you can't be on the slowest car on the grid. And it's not because I don't want to come last. It's because if you're in the slowest car on the grid, you've got no one to play with. And if you've got no one to play with, then, you know, that doesn't feel like racing. It's not that I've ever been in this situation, but, you know, I've imagined when I've seen people who are in cars which are wildly faster than theirs, and they just sort of run away and hide. And I can think to myself, well, okay, fine, you know, you get a pot at the end of it and you get to say you won the race, but have you had as much fun as the bloke down in 15th, 16th and 17th places who've just spent, you know, however many laps you're doing, absolutely tearing each other up and, you know, ducking and diving and trying this and trying that and doing everything you can to get past and to not let anybody past you. You know, who's had the most fun that weekend? I mean, in my mind, there's absolutely no contest. So as long as you're racing, I mean, that's what matters. Other things matter too. It matters, you know, some tracks are massively more entertaining than others. You know, the weather can play a part, all sorts of things can play a part. But as long as you're racing, as long as you're in the thick of it with other people, I don't think it really matters what you're in. You're racing, and that's all that counts.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely true. Right, so think back, and what was your first ever car race? And can you remember when it was?
Sorry, you caught me with a mouthful of tea there. yes, I can remember exactly when it was. I can remember pretty much every moment of it. It was 1994, so I was quite old even then. I was, 28? And it was just because before then, at Autocar, there was absolutely, you know, we had an editor who was just not interested in it and just thought that we, the road testers who all wanted a race, had no sort of editorial values at all. And we were just putting forward these story ideas, which involved us racing because we just wanted to get, you know, we just wanted to go racing.
Not entirely untrue.
Entirely true. But then there was a change at the top. And so a few of us, guys like me and Steve Sutcliffe and, you know, some old Autocar names, which may or may not be familiar to people listening to this, but guys like Ian Robinson and Gavin Conway and James Thomas, we had a Caterham, a company called Chasburger Motorsport prepared us a 1.4-litre K-series powered Caterham to do whatever the most junior level of Caterham racing was. And the idea was that we just I think there must have been five of us, and I think that there were like 10 rounds. So we'd do two rounds each, one at the beginning of the season, one at the middle of the season, and so on. And sadly, the car got written off at Lyddon Hill. I won't tell you who was in it, but it wasn't me. Most of us only got to do one race. And anyway, the race I did was 10 laps of the Indy Circuit at Brands. I mean, I wonder how many people's first races have been 10 laps of the Indy Circuit at Brands. It's a pretty sort of familiar way to get into it. But it's actually, even though it's a very short circuit, it's a very technical circuit. It's not an easy thing to figure your way around. And I was very lucky in that Ben Edwards, the great Formula One commentator who's just retired from the sport. I mean, he was a pretty formidable driver back then. And he's a lovely bloke, and he showed me around. I think must have had a practice day or something. So I sort of turned up. They drove the car down there, as he did back then. And he showed me around the track and showed me where to brake, showed me what the car can do. Yeah, it was wonderful. I qualified 12th. I think there must have been, I don't know, something like 24, 26 cars on the grid. So I was about halfway up, which I was really pleased with, because, you know, there were lots of people in there who'd done it for a long time and I'd never done it before. And in the race, I kind of got into a groove and I started doing reasonably well. I can remember coming out of Druids, the tight hairpin at the top, and I could get back on the power just sooner than anybody else. And I was trying to work out why it was. And then I realised it was because I was fatter than anybody else. And I weighed more than anybody else. And there was just more. I just had more traction because there was just more of me sitting on the back axle. So I did my best to make the most of that. And I kind of worked up my way up the field. And I found myself in fifth place. And I was challenging a bloke called Neil DeLaghi. I have no idea what happened to him. But anyway, for fourth place. And I tried to take the left-hander at Surtees flat. And I knew it was flat. I'd been told it was flat, but I'd never quite been able to do it. It was just a tiny lift. But I was desperate to get past this bloke. So I thought, right, this time I'm staying nailed. And I went through it flat and came out travelling backwards. How I didn't connect with anything, I have no idea. But I spun round and round and round and ended up on the grass, rejoined the race and finished 12th. Which was exactly the position I started the race in. So, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I, you know, ended up where I started. But massive fun. And going back to what I said earlier, that I was bitten. From that moment on, I knew I had to find a way to keep racing. What about you? What were you in?
Mine was quite a good stage, actually, for a first race. It was the first race of remembrance at Anglesey.
Oh, wow. So a proper long race as well.
Yeah, 2014.
So get your eye in.
Oh, yeah, that's true. In a Jota MX-5 again.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I probably like you, I approached it in a slightly bizarre way because I'd done so much circuit driving through work, just no racing. And Anglesey was... I was working at Evo at the time, which is why I got that drive. And Anglesey was a circuit that we used a lot. So I knew the place inside out.
What's the weather like?
Oh, my God. It was...
Anglesey weather.
It was like Anglesey in November. You know.
Funnily enough, yes.
Yeah, it was grim. And the nerves, not just on the grid, but the week leading up to it. And arriving at the circuit, seeing the whole setup, and just feeling sick to your stomach for hours on end.
Yes. And not being able to sleep the night before, and the fact that you can't sleep being the reason that you stay awake because you get so frustrated with not being able to sleep, you can't sleep. All of that.
And being, it's the funniest thing, being intimidated by a hands device and the fire extinguishers.
Yeah.
And just being reminded that this is real motorsport.
Yeah.
And just being a bit overwhelmed by all that stuff.
Yeah, I can remember turning up and just seeing all the trucks in the paddock.
Yeah.
All those big, shiny trucks. Yeah. And thinking, oh my God, this is so far out of my depth. I just drove the Caterham into the paddock. And there were all these big... And who are you sharing it with?
I was sharing it with a couple of the Mission Motorsport
beneficiaries.
Veterans. Yeah, exactly. Some good lads. A handful of others, but I was very lucky that Marino Franchitti was there, and he's a brilliant guy and a really good sort of coach, and just he kept me calm and, you know, just reassured me leading up to the race. And sadly, he actually didn't get to... He was supposed to race the car with us, but he had a North American license rather than a British one. And I don't think the Race of Remembrance had anticipated anyone with a North American license coming along. So he couldn't...
So this is a bloke who won the Sebring 12 hours.
Yeah.
Outright.
And he wasn't allowed
in. Five at Anglesey.
Yeah. It was a shame because... Yeah, I just wanted to share a car with my mate, you know.
Yeah, of course.
But even so, just having him there to sort of talk us through it was invaluable. But yeah, and so there are nerves in the days and hours leading up to it. But the nervousness as you get into the car for the first time, with everyone hurrying past down the pit straight, like you said, I would have chosen to be anywhere else at that point. Absolutely anywhere else. But then the instant you're out on circuit and you're through the first two corners and you think, oh, I can do this. I know how to drive a car. And then you just get on with it and that's it. You're hooked, aren't you? My first qualifying session was in torrential rain. And to date, it's the most exciting thing I've done in a car. And like you mentioned earlier, I just found this reserve of, I suppose it's courage that I had no clue I had, because ordinarily, if I'm driving on circuit and I can't see anything but the rain light in front of me, I'm just going to pull back. But because it was qualifying and I wanted to do well and the stopwatch was running and everyone was looking on, I kept my foot in and eventually got past that car that's kicking up all that spray. Maybe a grid of 20 cars or something. I qualified third.
Wow.
And it was...
Wow.
Yeah, it was...
Fair play.
It was... And the fastest MX-5 by a second. It was just the most incredible experience, that qualifying session. And then the race...
In particularly your first ever qualifying session, you know, and to this day, I still find this, that, you know, you have to... do your best in qualifying, because you go around there thinking, this, okay, it's qualifying, but what it actually is the dress rehearsal for the race. And you just think to yourself, and this is the way I think, is that, you know, if I can't even do this well, what chance have I got in the race? So you've got to try, and even though you can't do it quite because of all this other stuff I've already talked about, you've got to try and get your race face on in qualifying, haven't you? And you've got to do as well as you possibly can, because if you come out of that experience feeling that you've slightly underperformed or you're slightly scared or you've been a bit cowed by the whole thing, you know, the moment that you're out there and all those other cars aren't just cars that you're all trying to set a time, but they're competitors who are trying to stop you get past them, or you're trying to stop them come past you, then you could just be intimidated off the track. And there have been one or two times in my racing life where I've been in a car and I've been unhappy in the car. And it's just the worst feeling in the world. Also, I think you become very dangerous then to yourself. I think you're much more likely to have an accident because your mind's not on the job. You know, if you're not focused absolutely on what you're doing, if you're sitting there thinking, I am scared, then the thing to do is get it. You know, you're not having any fun. You know, if you're racing on your own, just retire the car. And if you're racing with a bunch of mates, bring it in and give it to somebody else and let them have a go. It's just, just thinking about it, I just hate it.
Yeah, I've never felt that, thankfully, but yeah, it sounds awful. Okay, right, I want you to put modesty to one side for a moment.
I find it very easy.
Because you've done a lot of racing over the years, and you've raced with some big teams, and data engineers will have gone through those speed traces with you. And I know that at some point, one of them will have said something flattering, okay? I'm sure that's true. So just imagine that you were 16 years old, plonked into a Formula Ford. Do you think you could have had a career?
No chance. Do I think I could have had a career? No, definitive answer, absolutely not, because I see today how many amazing drivers there are who are struggling to earn a living. And they spend their lives being scared, witless, being driven around tracks, instructing by total idiots. I can't imagine that, you know, when they were coming up through the ranks, doing karts and doing Formula Ford, that's how they imagined it was going to work out for them. And these are guys who, you know, if they drove anybody listening to this around the track, you would sit next to them, you'd be sitting next to them thinking, oh my God, this guy is just on a completely different level. And what we're talking about is, you know, guys who, you know, had they had the brakes, probably would be able to earn, you know, a decent, not great, but a decent career, as let us say, a sort of a hired GT3 driver or something like that. But there are just so many of them. There are so many people who are at that level. And it's a really, really high level. Frankly, it's a level that is higher than almost any, not absolutely any journalist, but all but a tiny number of motoring journalists ever get to. And I wouldn't say that I was at that level. Now, if I had huge amounts of money and I'd done it from, you know, I'd been karting when I was 8 instead of doing my first race when I was 28. I mean, I suppose you don't know. I don't know how much you could have learnt, how much you could have trained your brain in that time when it was still young and, you know, soaking up information. And maybe, you know, they always said that about Graham Hill, didn't they? That he wasn't an innately talented racing driver, but he just worked harder than anybody else. And he won 2 world championships. And I know some really famous racing drivers who will say, there is nothing that I do that you could not be taught to do. And I've never really believed it. But, you know, if you ask for a gut opinion, there's no, I don't think I could. If I could, it would have been at the lowest level possible. And I would have probably ended up instructing, and which I would have absolutely hated. But to me, that doesn't... I can't tell you how little it bothers me. Because, frankly, unless you're Lewis, there's always someone who's going to be quicker than you. Always. Doesn't matter who you are. There is always going to be someone quicker than you. And frankly, there's always going to be someone who's slower than you. So where you are in that pecking order, I mean, I wouldn't want to be thought of as a duffer. And, you know, and I know that there are some people in all forms, not all, but most forms of recreational racing, who just go out there and they wander around. And I've never had a problem with them as long as they keep out of the way. But I have often thought, you know, you're not really racing. You're just being out there. And, you know, and that's fine. I wouldn't want that. But at the same time, I have no illusions at all. I would describe, in fact, I always have described myself as being to a reasonably good, competent, you know, club racer standard, which means that if you give me a really decent car in a, you know, reasonably decent race, I'll do reasonably well in it. But I don't think I would ever profess to, you know, anything more than that. What about you?
Well, I think if I'd started karting at 8, I'd have a sack full of F1 titles by now.
Yeah, well, indeed. Me too. I agree. I mean, I've shared cars with you. I completely concur.
No. I mean, like you say, you never know what might have happened if you'd started in a go-kart as when you were just a little kid. But I suspect, you know, the track driving that I've done, the racing that I've done, I think I'm a reasonably skillful, smooth, clean, quick driver. But you know, I can get within a second, maybe half a second, of some really quick guys who are, I've done some mini challenge racing, and I can get within a second of guys who are winning that race, qualifying on pole, and those are British touring car standard guys. You know, they're going really hard, but I don't think I will ever make up that final second or half second.
No.
because there's a fear aspect that I don't think I'll overcome, because frankly I don't need to. It's not really worth it for me. You know, I'm not there to take those risks to try and prove that I'm a remarkably talented driver. I'm not pursuing a career, so I just don't think I would ever take enough of a chance to take that final leap. So I don't think I ever had it in me to have a career. No.
And I think that there's another thing. You know, I have, you know, I've done a few races where I've had some fairly, you know, well-known teammates. And I have on occasion surprised myself by how close I've got to them in qualifying. Sometimes I've been on their pace. But of course, you forget that qualifying is one lap.
Yeah, yeah.
And what they can do is whatever that time is, times however many laps the race is. Whereas what I've done is I've taken my brain out, shut my eye and hope for the best for that one lap. And I couldn't string 2, let alone 20 of them together to save my life. And at the end of a race, that's why they end up 25 seconds down the road from you. Because, you know, they can just do that all the time. Because, you know, unlike you, who are, you know, absolutely white knuckling it, wringing every single thing you can out of yourself, they're just doing their job. They've just gone to work. They're sitting at their desk doing what they do, and that's what happens when you do that. And that to me is the really, really big difference. And you know, I do every year I toddle off to do this ridiculous 6-hour historic race at Spa, which is probably my happiest time. It's certainly the best weekend of my year. I haven't done it this year, which I'm not at all bitter about. But anyway, but you know, the guys up the front in that, who are the creme de la creme of the historic racing car world, you know, whether it's light or whether it's dark or whether it's dry or whether it's chucking it down, they are just, you know, they have a pace and they just stick to it. You know, they have a dry pace, they have a wet pace, and they are always on it, lap after lap. Sometimes I just watch the timing screens, and you know, sometimes they get held up by traffic, but in clear air they are just totally consistent and totally on it all the time. And you know, and if I want to be totally consistent, I have to slow down. I have to drive at 9/10 rather than 10/10. And so, you know, that has consequences. You know, the car goes backwards. So, yeah, I have no illusions, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and it's a tough old world, that professional driver life, because there's such scrutiny, particularly in the GT world. I've heard people say that if your outlap is half a second too slow because you're a little bit cautious, or you took too long to get past a car and you lost a bit of lap time, the teams will be looking at that in microscopic detail, and you could lose your seat as a result of that. And, you know, you can extrapolate that all the way out to Formula One. What's Valtteri Bottas' reputation as a racing driver? He's, you know, probably that he got lucky to find himself in the fastest car, win a handful of F1 races, but ultimately nowhere near the level required to beat Lewis Hamilton and be world champion, which is just bonkers, because there are people out there who ran Bottas when he was a junior driver. I think it's Team Parker Racing, isn't it, the UK team? They ran him in a single-seater, and all the engineers there and the mechanics, they still regard him as the greatest driver of all time, because he did something completely bonkers in a little single-seater at Pembrey or whatever. You know, his talent is off the dial, and yet his reputation is for being a so-so F1 driver. The scrutiny is unbelievable.
It is, and you are so right. You know, it's only really happened to me once. I did another 24-hour race at Silverstone. This was a long time ago. I was racing a GT3 Jaguar XKR that was being run by Richard Lloyd, the late, great, wonderful Richard Lloyd. And I'd only got the drive at the last moment. I didn't fit the car and yada, yada, yada. And in the middle of the night, I was going around, and I thought I was doing quite well. And my crew chief came on the radio and went, "Andrew, we really do need you to speed up a bit. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, completely understand. We'll pull you in and we'll stick somebody else in the car."
Wow.
And I just felt crushed. I really did. Because I know that for him to have got on the horn, to have felt so strongly to get on the blower to me and tell me that, I just thought about the conversations that would have gone in the pit beforehand. And that's just one tiny little example in a not very, you know, quick car and a not massively important race. But you know, the way that people are assessed these days, and also data. I did a GT4 race in a McLaren at Spa year before last. And that's the first time, because almost all my racing has been in the historics world. It's really been the only time that I've sat down and really done a proper race weekend with proper data and proper data analysts and people showing me everything. I could not believe it. It felt to me like cheating, because I was just finding massive chunks of time, not by being a better driver, but by just analysing and understanding the data. And I know I wasn't doing anything which, you know, everybody else wasn't doing too, but it felt like I was being given an unfair advantage, because, you know, the guys who've got the natural talent, you know, should be that much faster, and they weren't. And I discovered, apparently, you know, you've mentioned this to anybody who races GT3 cars or whatever, and they just laugh and go, "Of course." You know, they spend much more time looking at data than they ever do driving their cars. And you know, and what you were saying, you know, you come out and you are just a fraction off on your outlap, or you don't absolutely maximize every opportunity on your inlap. You know, let's say, you know, you're coming down the pit lane and, you know, you go under the pit lane speed when you're 10 yards away from the line rather than absolutely on the line. And they've calculated that's cost them a tenth of a second or something. And you know you're being judged for that. To me, that's the moment motor racing stops being fun. And if you talk to the guys, and I think we've probably mentioned this on this podcast before, but guys like, you know, Darren Turner, all the heroes who do, you know, proper frontline, top draw professional motor racing, and then also cock about in old sheds at Goodwood. They always prefer the cocking about in old sheds at Goodwood because, you know, ultimately they're just out there having a laugh. You know, no one is, you know, as long as they do well and go sideways, that's all anybody requires of them. And, you know, that's what I want to go motor racing for. I don't want to go motor racing to spend more time sitting in a truck looking at a screen than sitting in a car and driving it.
Mm. Okay, well, that's a good question. I think you've probably answered it there. You've raced modern cars, you've raced older cars. If you could only race one kind of car for the rest of your time?
Oh, I'd definitely race older cars. And for a few different reasons. One is I'm now just dialed into the way old cars handle, and I drive them in the way that old cars need to be driven. And I actually, when I get in a modern, I was driving a Radical the other day, the new SR10, and when I get in cars like that, I'm always mindful of the fact that there's stuff, not only that there's stuff I have to learn about the car, but there's also stuff I have to unlearn about the way that I drive cars. Also, you know, the older you get, this is going to make me sound so old, but, you know, the less comfortable the forces on your body become. You know, that Radical was, well, corner, I think, 2.3G. You know, stuff I've driven before, that Rodin thing that I drove in New Zealand a year ago, will probably corner at 4G. And, you know, I'm 15 stone on a good day, and, you know, I don't particularly appreciate weighing 45 stone or 60 stone. And so, you know, whereas if you're in some old shed on skinny little, you know, racing Dunlops, you know, that's not going to be a problem. And, you know, I just love skidding about. It's silly, I know, but I love cars that are expressive, I guess. And those old sheds are, I mean, they all go sideways. Indeed, you know, those old Dunlop racing tyres, you know, they are designed to work with a slip angle. And so if you're not drifting them, you're not driving the car properly. And I just love all that. And things happen more slowly, so you've got more time to react to it, and on and on and on. I really love the people who do it. I love the look of all the cars, the variety of all the cars, the, you know, some of the mad old tracks we get to go and do it on, like Goodwood. Yeah, I'm just, I guess because it's the world I've been brought up in and the age that I've reached now, I'm just happier in that world. But, you know, a young whippersnapper like you would probably feel entirely differently, and, you know, and give anything to get out there in something with slicks and wings.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I've never raced anything with any downforce. Have you?
Well, bits, yeah, GT3, GT4. So, I mean, yeah, you know, downforce by old shed standards, but no downforce by
single seater. Yeah,
but I've driven plenty of cars with plenty of downforce, so I absolutely understand you know what downforce is and what it enables a car to do, and I find it fascinating. But I find it kind of academically fascinating. I'm really, really curious about it, but I don't. It doesn't sort of, you know, get me. You know, if I can drive an old Alfa around somewhere like Donington in the wet, you know, there's a good chance that if I get off the track, it's because I'm laughing so much. I genuinely, if anybody ever had a camera in the car, it's one of the reasons, they would just hear me hooting with laughter all the way around. And I'd never get that in something like that. I'd be sitting there thinking, well, obviously, I don't want to crash it, and I'm not very comfortable with these feelings I'm being subjected to, but this is really interesting. And I want to find out more because, you know, this is an education for me, and yeah, and I find it, you know, academically really, really interesting, but it doesn't stir my soul.
Yeah, I get that, and actually, I feel that I'm more drawn to the idea of historic motorsport than modern slicks and wings stuff. I'm also, I don't like getting beaten up in a car. And, you know, it's why I've got a sort of love-hate relationship with karting. I own a kart, but whenever I get in it, more to the point, I get out of it going, ouch, I'm really sore. And I just, you know, I'm not sure I really love that stuff anymore. And I don't get on with cars with really heavy, unassisted steering that you fight with. I just really struggle with those. I remember Jethro Bovingdon saying to me that as long as a racing car's got ABS, he's happy. And I think
that's
for me, it's, yeah, and I think for me, it's as long as it's got power steering, I'm much happier. Even in a Caterham, it's, you know, it's not, the steering in those cars is not particularly heavy, but it's, there's so much feedback that you're still sort of wrestling with it a little bit. And I find that wrestling an impediment to me getting sort of turning right and all that stuff. So I'm sort of, I'm more able to be competitive in something like the Mini Challenge, which is, I suppose, a more conventional car with power steering than something like a Caterham. So, you know, given the opportunity, I'd still jump into a little single-seater and have a blast. But, yeah, I think I'd rather skid around something old at Goodwood. That sort of appeals to me a bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is wonderful. Yeah. Mm.
So what's the absolute fastest thing you've raced?
Yes, I'm having to think about this, aren't I?
The That's absolute. Okay.
Well, I mean, okay. So, in my historic world, which is really the world I inhabit, there's a car called a Lister Costin Coupe, which won the Goodwood TT last year after very many years of trying. It did it. It got over the line and it won it. This is the car that Chris Harris came second in 2013. So nearly won it. But the weather, he had an amazing first stint in it. And I think they'd qualified third and he'd handed it over well in the lead, having completely dusted John Alesi in a 250 GTO. And gave it over to Anthony Reid. Who the weather turned and the car was never very easy to drive in the wet, and he spun it, and an old Aston driven by the very, very talented Simon Hadfield nipped through and took the win. So, but anyway, but I raced that car when it had, I'm making excuses now, I know, but it genuinely had an old and not particularly healthy engine in it. I used to race it a lot, actually, but the particular race I'm talking about was the TT. Was it the year before that, 2011, when I shared it with Richard Atwood, and we had a sick engine, and it didn't like Goodwood's petrol for some reason, and we actually got it running properly in the end by going to Sainsbury's and getting the fuel from there. And then we had weather problems. But that's probably, in historics, that's probably the quickest. You know, I've never raced a historic Formula One car or anything like that. I'd probably quite like to, I think. But, you know, for me, it's not really the speed of the car. If you can be in something, you know, because there are lots of cars that, you know, by modern standards really aren't that quick, and not even the Lister is that quick by modern standards. Although, you know, it was lapping, I think this year, it was doing about a sort of 125, 126 round Goodwood. And you need a pretty bloody rapid road car to match that time. And this was a car that was designed 60 years ago. And what do I think you'd need to do? I'm not sure a new GT3 RS would do a 126 round there. It might, but you'd need something like that, something of that order to get down to those sorts of speeds. So that was, you know, that was a very cool car. But as I said, it's more. I mean, I get terribly enough if I'm lucky enough to race some amazing things, and I have. It's the history of the cars, and particularly if I'm racing them somewhere which is in itself very historic, then I can just get completely romanced, totally romanced with the whole thing.
Let's round this podcast up with a bit of advice for people wanting to get started in racing, and I'll make a start. And I think that rather than go racing straight away, it's worth considering doing an auto solo or an auto test or a sprint. And it's because I found the procedural stuff leading up to the race is sort of baffling and intimidating and as worrying as driving the car itself, knowing where you have to be and when, scrutineering, signing on, getting all that stuff right. And I just think it would be quite sensible to grow accustomed to all of that more basic stuff before plonking yourself on a grid full of other cars.
You're absolutely right. Or just go and spectate. I mean, I was very lucky in this regard in that my elder brother used to race Alpha Suds, of all things, years and years ago. And I was a sort of, you know, fanboy, so I used to go along. And I used to help push the car to scrutineering, and I'd go in the car with him to the assembly area and all that sort of thing. So I kind of knew how all that worked, and, you know, signing on and all the other, you know, the endless stuff you have to do in order to spend 10 minutes whizzing around the track. And I think absolutely get used to being on the track. If you can do anything competitive, as you say, like, you know, auto test or whatever, then that's great. But also just go and, you know, if you don't already, just go and spectate. And, you know, just go up to the scrutineering bay and ask the scrutineer if you can just stand and watch them do what they do and watch the people come in and the bits of paper that you get given and, you know, go down to the assembly. All these things, if you're talking about grassroots club level motorsport, none of these places are difficult to get to. No one's going to say boo to you. You know, and you're absolutely right. You know, the more normal all that seems to you, the less intimidated you will be when finally it's you who are going to be on the grid.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, anything else that you want to say about racing? It's a good topic, isn't it? And we could probably keep going for a lot longer.
I think there's plenty I would say about racing. I mean, I think we've made it sound quite difficult, but obviously the most difficult thing is the money. And the thing, you know, what advice would I give? You know, just being able to buy a brake, you know, if you think about, you know, racing a car and you think, well, I can probably afford the car and I know what the entry fees is, you know, just... You know, racing eats money, and it's not just when you're out on the track. You've obviously got your consumables, your tyres and your brake pads and all that sort of thing. You've got to at least be prepared for, you know, a big bill, because cars do blow up, cars do get crashed, and you've got to be able to, you know, look that one in the eye. But also, it's, you know, it's immensely time consuming, and there are just other costs, you know, things like, you know, if you haven't got one, you know, renting a trailer or something that you can tow a car with, you know, hotel accommodation while you're there, fuel costs getting there, getting back, this, that and the other, you know, your license fee, depending on what grade you get, you know, getting your license. And if you're old, you know, if you're over 45 and you want to race an international level, and I know this because I've got to have one done myself fairly shortly, you've got to have a stress-related ECG, and that's another £600 down the drain. So you've just got to look at it, you know, in a brutally honest way, because there are lots of people who really love the idea of racing, tried it, have not been realistic about the cost of doing it, and have found themselves falling in love with racing but not being able to do it because they can't afford it. But if you can... And you are sensible about the money side of thing, and you don't have to be Lewis, Valtteri, or anybody else. You have to be safe, and I think if you are just a good driver, a good, safe, clean, fast, smooth driver, then there is no reason in the world why, if you get yourself a half decent car, you can't get out and go racing at a club level in the UK and have an absolute ball. And I think if you look at it in those terms, I would recommend it to absolutely everyone, because there are so few things, particularly in motoring, where suddenly you discover stuff you never knew, but you didn't even know could be known. And what I was saying at the beginning about finding this other stuff within yourself, and, you know, and I've been racing for whatever it is, you know, decades, and I'm still finding out stuff, and I'm still surprising myself, and I'm still loving it. So, you know, I think be realistic, but don't be put off, because I think if you can do it, it is utterly wonderful. And I can't recommend it highly enough.
It's been just over 4 years since I last raced.
Oh my goodness.
I know. I really need to do something about that in 2021. That should be the target. Just go and race something.
We need a Drive Nation, or whatever we're going to be, sponsored race car, don't we? We need someone to come to us and go, listen, we'd just love to have your name all over our car. I can't see it happening, but we should do it. And I've never raced with you. I'd love to do that. I'd love to go and do a long distance something or other, and you and I just cock about in the car.
It'd be good fun, wouldn't it?
I just want to know how much faster than me you are.
No. It'd be absolutely the other way around. I'd be hopeless, but I'd be there to learn, so it's okay. Doubt it. Good. Oh, I just want to go racing now. Okay. Well, normally I end these podcasts by saying we'll talk to you again next week. But we're not going
Will we? No, we don't. No, we record these things on a Friday, and next Friday is Christmas Day, and love to spend our Christmas Day chatting with you lot. Though we would, we have families who may have other ideas about that. So we're going to give ourselves a week off, aren't we?
We are. We are. But we will be back first thing in the new year, and we'll crack on from there. 2021 is going to be a big year for us, we hope. So you know, just. All that's left to be said is thank you to every single one of you for supporting us throughout this year. And for those of you who have bunged us a few quid on Patreon, you know, truly a heartfelt thank you to all of you. It's been a tough year at times, isn't it? And I'm sure that 2021 will be a better one for us. And I hope it is for all of you as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's a person listening to this who hasn't been, you know, adversely affected by all the stuff that's been going on. And I think that, you know, motoring journalists have probably been a lot luckier than most. But yeah, just to echo what Dan says, thank you so much for everybody who stuck with us. I'd just like to put my hand in the air and just say that I never thought that podcasting would work. And clearly I've been, like so many other things, I was completely wrong about that. But thank you for staying with us. Thank you for all the people who have said nice things to us. Thank you for all the people who haven't said nasty things to us despite thinking them. And yeah, we just really, really look forward to the new year. We hope you have a wonderful Christmas, and we'll catch up with you for what is going to be, for us at least, a very different sort of year. And we'll share with you all the stuff that we're up to over time. But in the meantime, yeah, have a great Christmas, happy new year, and we'll catch up with you in 2021.
Yeah, have a good break, everyone. Speak soon.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.